There are so many times where I was like, I cannot believe the world does not know Manny Ellis's name. I can't believe people are 35 miles away in Seattle shouting George Floyd's name when Manny Ellis died right here.
I feel like Manny was targeted.
It's like I'm continually reliving this moment, trying to prepare myself over and over and over again.
It's been 3 years since Manny Ellis, a 33-year-old black man, died in Tacoma police custody.
Did he do it? What do you think happened? Was he on drugs?
3 years since his little sister, Monet Carter Mixon, decided to figure out what happened to him. She uncovered eyewitness videos.
Stop! Oh my God, stop hitting him!
Rallied community support.
Manny Ellis!
And help change state law.
The office formed the Task Force on Independent Investigations of Police Use of Force following the death of Manuel Ellis. The bill creates a new office to conduct competent, unbiased investigations. For that, I'm signing House Bill 1267.
Now, in mid-September, the officers involved will stand trial for murder and manslaughter.
I want them to spend their time thinking about what happened and in jail.
It's one of the most high-profile cases in Pacific Northwest history. From KNKX and the Seattle Times, this is The Walk Home. I'm KNKX Special Projects reporter Mayowa Aina. And on this episode of The Walk Home, we take a look at the upcoming trial. What's at stake? What to expect? And what its impact could be.
Good evening, it's 5:04. I'm Emil Moffitt with KNKX News. A small group of demonstrators blocked an intersection in Tacoma this evening after a jury acquitted all three police officers on all counts in connection to the March 2020 killing of Manuel Ellis, a 33-year-old black man. KNKX reporter Mayowa Aina was at the intersection of 11th Street and Martin Luther King Way in Tacoma's Hilltop neighborhood. That's where Ellis's sister, Monet Carter Mixon, has led a group to block the street.
And Monet Carter Mixon, Manny Ellis's sister, is furious, I would say, to say the least, about the verdict, and is imploring people to come out of their buildings, get out of their cars. She's stopping traffic to share her opinion about what's happened in the trial.
And that verdict again, officers Matthew Collins, Christopher Shane Burbank, and Timothy Rankin were found not guilty of all charges in connection to Ellis's death. Defense attorneys argued that Ellis attacked the officers and a toxic dose of methamphetamine stopped his enlarged heart. The officers await a decision about their employment from Police Chief Avery Moore, who joined the department in January of 2022. Meanwhile, lawyers who defended the officers are reacting to the verdict as well. Casey Arbenz, lawyer for Collins, thanked his co-counsel.
What you saw there was the product of several years of looking into this case and all the facts, and really looking beyond just the short snippets and the videos and some of the witness statements, but actually getting into the evidence. And what you saw and what the jury saw was that this really wasn't a case. It should have never been charged. It should have never been brought. And we're just thrilled that the jury came out not guilty.
Arbenz calls the verdict a sigh of relief for the officers. It's 5:32. I'm Emil Moffitt with KNKX News. Good evening. The city of Tacoma says it expects to complete its internal investigation by tomorrow into the three police officers who were found not guilty today in connection with the March 2020 killing of Manuel Ellis, a 33-year-old black man. In a news release, the city says within 14 days of the jury announcing its verdict, Police Chief Avery Moore will make a final decision on potential discipline, which may include termination. An investigation into officers Matthew Collins, Christopher Shane Burbank, and Timothy Rankin had been on pause as the trial was ongoing. The city says its police department resumed the investigation after testimony concluded. The internal review will include testimony officers provided during the trial. Community organizer and recently elected Tacoma City Council member Jamika Scott is joining those critical of today's not guilty verdict. She says deaths like Ellis's will continue to happen if things don't change.
We're sick of it. And if you're sick of seeing us, then do better. Because the only reason we're standing in this street is because people aren't doing better by the people who are standing in this street, who are living in these streets, who have nothing going for them and everything being from them by people who have more than enough.
Scott was a longtime vocal advocate in the effort to bring the officers to trial after Ellis's death. Stay with KNKX this evening and tomorrow for Morning Edition. We have a team of reporters gathering community reaction in Tacoma of city leaders and legal experts. We also have continuous live updates at our website, knkx.org.
KNKX reporter Scott Greenstone is following one new state lawmaker through her first session. Representative Charlotte Mena from Tacoma is getting a crash course in what it takes to make progress in a legislative body that can seem just as immovable as the marble walls of the Capitol building itself. Today, we're going across the street where the new lawmakers have their offices.
And here we are. Hola.
Start of session is day after tomorrow. Today, it's move-in day at J-Lob, the House office building in Olympia. Representative Charlotte Mena is getting help from her friends, her boyfriend, her mom. They're putting up pictures, decor.
So this, the United Farm Worker flag, came, Dolores Huerta came.
That's American labor leader Dolores Huerta, the originator of the phrase, si se puede.
She signed that one for me, and it's one of my favorite things because, like, my mom did farm work, you know, and, like, to have someone that was able to organize in a community that people say are unorganizable. It's just not true, right? Like, we can do it. We put our minds to it. I can't look at my mom. She makes me cry. So, and then some of these photos my mom took and gifted to me in these frames. This is from our home state, Sinaloa. This is Mazatlán.
Juicy by the notorious B.I.G. is playing on her phone. It's kind of appropriate. In it, Biggie talks about how far he's come. Today, Charlotte Mena is being sworn in. She'll take the oath of office with one hand on the Washington State Constitution and her grandmother's rosary.
I think it's a perfect day to use it. You're going to use it, right? Like,
so I'm taking the oath of office on that.
In her family's Catholic tradition, when you pray the rosary, you're praying for future generations. So these rosary beads, in a way, hold prayers for Mena.
Are you okay, Mom?
I just been crying in the morning.
Are you nervous?
No, I'm just emotional.
Every time I've seen Mena, she's been light-humored. Unflappable almost, but underneath, she is nervous about the road ahead.
Yeah.
We talked the night before she was sworn in on the phone.
I don't know if dread is the word, but there's a little bit of sort of just like worry about what you don't know, you know?
Yeah.
I want to do so well. I want to do so right by this district. I want to make sure that folks that entrusted me with legislation that they carried last session or an idea, you know, don't feel like I dropped the ball. And I'm going to work really hard to make sure that I don't. I think there's just an irrational worry about, well, what if I do?
Irrational worry or not, the session is starting. Here we go.
This song has been on repeat, you guys. Okay.
I was like, is that your song? Is that your...
No, I just played it once and then it just was going.
Same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
The Constitution and laws of the state of Washington.
Dream. Representative Charlotte Mena is one of 43 new members to join the House of Representatives, the most diverse body in state history.
It makes me excited and a little scared.
Her first bill was one of the first to get a hearing this session.
This bill will simply prevent toxics from going into cosmetics.
That's a King 5 report about the first of many bills.
This is the heifer. You put in the bill and then it gets filed. That's it. It's done. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill to protect Washingtonians against extreme heat.
To access the promise of the Washington Voting Rights Act.
Gender-based pricing, often called the pink tax.
This bill provides a quick solution to this issue by allowing sound transit
and
to...
surgical fix to a loophole that we found in our campaign finance
both
laws.
State and tribal fish hatcheries to perform the important operation
House
maintenance.
Bill 1427, affectionately referred to as the Solar Energy Resiliency Bill.
She is working on all of those?
Literally, yeah. Like, this one just...
It's more than a month into session. In the last 5 weeks, Mena has introduced 12 bills. Her office has been a carousel, spinning through meetings with constituents like these people, business owners, advocates, lobbyists, rushing through for 15 minutes each. Some want her to vote yes or no on a bill they like.
A report commissioned by U.S. Soccer investigating allegations of misconduct in the National Women's Soccer League shook the soccer world when it was released last fall. The report, authored by former Deputy U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates, detailed systemic abuse by coaches and staff. Professional players interviewed for the report said the misconduct they experienced was normalized when they were children. There are a handful of youth soccer clubs across the nation that produce top talent. Crossfire Premier in Redmond is one of those, for both girls and boys. An investigation by KNKX found allegations of racial and sexual harassment, player endangerment, and inappropriate touching of underage players at Crossfire. KNKX reporter Grace Madigan has the story. And the story, which is about 12 minutes long, includes a racial slur and sexually explicit language. Take care while listening.
I interviewed over 20 players, coaches, parents, and others for this investigation into Crossfire Premier. The two coaches named in the story have denied any wrongdoing. In 2014, Elise Morris, who uses she-they pronouns, was entering freshman year of high school when they joined Crossfire Premier. At the time, Crossfire had one of the highest-ranked girls' teams in Washington State for their age group.
I was aiming to go D1, and so I just needed to be at the best club and the best team.
Morris was spending 6 days a week at a soccer field and countless hours traveling to practices and games. Billy Wiskel was their coach for the 2 years they were at the club. Morris says Wiskel's criticisms about their body and their play were constant and harsh. They say it made them feel so bad they considered leaving the sport.
I developed an eating disorder during that time. I had such a negative self-image. You learn who you are through your sport if you're playing at that level. And the things that Billy was teaching me was to hate myself, was to hate others.
Several of Morris's Crossfire teammates spoke to KNKX, but requested to remain anonymous because of their close ties with the club and because they are still involved with soccer. The player said Wiskel made verbal attacks that were often personal, commenting on players' bodies, making racial remarks, and questioning if someone deserved to be playing at such a high level. One player is Japanese.
He would actually say something like, before a game, like, did you eat panda for breakfast? I'm like, Billy, what? Like, why do you say this all this stuff? You know, like, it's not a funny joke.
The racist remark she says Wiskel made went far beyond what anyone could consider humorous.
He would greet me, actually, every day before practice, ching chong ching.
Another player called Wiskel smart and says he knew his stuff as a coach. But she also recalled the racial comments he'd make. The player's mom is black.
They were just like little comments, like if I like wore my hair braided, like he would be like, oh, like Snoop Dogg's here, like stuff like that.
In an interview with KNKX, another teammate recalled Wiskel pressuring players into performing a sexually suggestive dance move. The former Crossfire player asked that her voice not be used in this story. She says the team of teenage girls was at a hotel for an away tournament out of state. They gathered in a conference room to get ice cream when Wiskel told two players to twerk. She says she heard him joke that they wouldn't get any ice cream if they didn't. She says Wiskel called over a male hotel employee and said, hey, watch this. An investigation into allegations against Wiskel by an oversight agency called the U.S. Center for Safe Sport was closed last spring. Reached by phone, Wiskel said he was cleared and specifically denied ever making racial comments to his players. Baumgart says Safe Sport notified her the last week of April this year that they had closed their investigation. She says they told her they had given James a warning, but that there was insufficient evidence to support sanctions. Safe Sport repeatedly said they could not release information or comment on their investigation or how the case was resolved. KNKX reached out to James. He read a statement.
The allegations against me and my conduct were unfounded and dismissed. I would like to thank everyone for their participation and honesty in the investigative process. I will continue coaching at Crossfire and will continue to unlock our players' potential through effective and supportive coaching.
When the Yates report finding misconduct at the pro level was released in October, Baumgart says it validated her decision to speak up about Crossfire.
You know, obviously I was a part of that culture for 13 years and I chose to stay, and there are a lot of things that I, you know, disagreed with. And, you know, stepping away from it, being away from it for the past year, you realize kind of really how bad it really was.
Shortly after SaySport closed the case, Baumgart called to tell me she decided to retire from coaching club soccer. Bernie James and Billy Wiskel continue to coach at Crossfire. Grace Madigan, KNKX News.
For a period of more than a dozen years in the 60s and 70s, a unique kind of whale hunter operated in the United States. Orca hunters captured and sold whales to aquariums, primarily from the Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest. Eventually, the practice became illegal, and the last of these southern resident orcas, known by her stage name Lolita, died earlier this month in an aquarium in Miami. Many of the Lummi Nation in Washington State considered her family. From member station KNKX, Bellamy Palethorpe reports.
Hundreds of people gathered over the weekend at a beachside park on San Juan Island for a celebration of the orca's life. They burned sweetgrass, laid flowers and feathers, artwork and signs around a big, colorful carving of her. One of the artists, Lummi carver Doug James, shared a whale song for healing. The event was originally planned as a dedication ceremony for the story pole, but after her unexpected death, it became a kind of memorial. Part of the ceremony included recordings of what is thought to be some of the orca's last calls from her tank. Those calls brought tears to the eyes of many gathered on the beach, still processing the shock of her death.
I mean, the last time we got an update, she was coming home, and there were plans for that to take place.
Tony Hilaire is chairman of Lummi Nation. The tribe called her by the name Scully Chuktanut. Until recently, they were calling for her release into a net pen sanctuary. Hilaire explains that the tribe's teachings say orcas are their relations under the sea.
That they are our elders. They are the ones who guide us. They're the ones who teach us how to navigate these waters, how to fish and hunt and live this way of life.
He says now Scully Chuktanut's spirit is free, and people can take comfort in knowing that soon her cremated remains will be brought home by Lummi elders. But the day after she died, the dolphin company, who owned her, sent her body out for a necropsy. The tribe says they weren't consulted.
Like any family member, you know, we want to be talked to when decisions like that are made.
He says they view her as a lost relation. She survived in a tiny tank for more than 50 years after being trapped with underwater bombs and nets and taken from her family when she was just 4 years old. He says there's still many unanswered questions about how and why she died.
So we're trying to find balance between, you know, finding those answers as well as making sure that there's a better process moving forward.
Scully Chuktanut's whale family is what scientists call the L-pod. Biologist Deborah Giles was out on the water with them the day that she died. Giles says they were unusually social, vocalizing above the water with lots of breaching. Some thought this orca family somehow sensed that her spirit had been released.
You know, I like to think about what other people have said, that they envisioned that she came back and that she was swimming with them.
Giles started following the efforts to bring Scully Chuktanut home nearly four decades ago when she was just 16 years old. She says these spiritual theories are comforting at a time of great loss.
You know, my brain doesn't really go there very easily, but I'd like to, you know, it's like a waking dream.
It's not just this one whale she's grieving. This species of orca is endangered, with a dwindling food supply of salmon and other environmental hazards. There are only 73 of them left in the whole world. Giles warns unless something drastic changes, these whales could soon go extinct. For NPR News, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe in the San Juan Islands.
As part of our KNKX Connects to Tacoma series, we asked listeners to tell us what Tacoma sounds like. You sent us everything from your school traditions to your walks in the park. KNKX Special Projects reporter Mayowa Aina has this story about what Tacoma sounds like to you.
I'm going to start with myself. When I thought about what Tacoma sounds like, the first thing I could think of was this spot in downtown Tacoma. So I am down by the dock near the entrance to the Museum of Glass. And there are these, I guess you could call them xylophones. but they are outdoors. All of the mallets are gone, so I just used my hands to play them. We would come down here and hang out and look at the Tacoma Dome, look at the bridge, and look at the boats.
And music became sort of a theme in our submissions. Paul Blanchard sent us this piece of music history. This particular version of the iconic song was recorded in Tacoma in 1961 by Rockin' Robin Roberts and the Wailers. Paul points out this version includes one famous riff.
Yeah, 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 I'll say it, low, low, yeah. Oh.
That yeah, 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 yeah would go on to be emulated by hundreds of rock artists and audiences. Paul says the rest is rock and roll history. Another cheer comes to us from...
Hi, my name is Calvin. I live in Tacoma, and this is the sound of the loggers.
And in case you missed that, the call is "All my life, I want to be a logger," and the response is "Hack, hack, chop, chop." Here's how Calvin, a recent 2023 UPS graduate, describes it.
This recording comes from the University of Puget Sound's Baker Stadium during the 2023 convocation.
It might not be famous worldwide, but if you've been to the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma's North End, it's a cheer you've probably heard any enthusiastic logger yell.
Tacoma's been the home of the loggers since 1888, and Puget Sound's first years have been learning this cheer for generations.
For the younger students in our community, Anna Eisenman takes us to Tacoma's east side for the first ever Beyond the Bell Soccer Jamboree at Stewart Heights Park this fall. Anna says 66 soccer teams from 37 elementary schools throughout the Tacoma School District showcase their skills in a no-score round-robin tournament. Across town now to the Point Defiant Zoo and Aquarium, we receive this submission from Katie Cotterill.
Hi, my name is Katie, and I'm the staff photographer at Point Defiant Zoo and Aquarium. This is the sound of simangs, endangered red wolves, and walruses, some of the zoo animals you can hear throughout Tacoma.
She says you can hear these animals in the park or even throughout the nearby Ruston area. But for some peace and quiet, Sage Hughes brought us sound from a walk with her dog Arlo along Chambers Bay in University Place.
You can hear us stepping on pieces of driftwood, and hopefully you can hear the water, and maybe if I stop talking, you can also hear a biwing airplane overhead. And that was just my dog shaking off the water after dipping himself into... after dipping himself into the sound.
This is just a little of what Tacoma sounds like to you. Maya Wa'aina, KNKX News.
Our KNKX Connects to Tacoma series continues all week. You can find all our stories in the series at knkx.org/connects.
Immigrants are being deported out of Boeing Field again after King County lost its fight in court. Each week, volunteers with local activist groups now go to watch as officials with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement take people from the Tacoma Detention Center and put them on planes. KNKX reporter Liliana Fowler went to see it.
It's a little after 8 a.m. Activist Stan Shikuma is about to get on his bike and ride from South Seattle to Boeing Field. He uses a flight tracker to find out when a deportation flight is landing. The airline is always Aero Airways. It contracts with ICE. Shikuma, a retired nurse, is wearing a black T-shirt that on the back reads, "No more U.S. concentration camps." He says the detention of immigrants by ICE reminds him of how his Japanese-American family was held in internment camps.
There's no sentence, like, they don't know how long they'll be there.
Like his family members, he says, the immigrants have an indefinite sentence, even though they aren't in detention because they've committed a crime.
Could be a week, it could be a year, and no one can tell them which.
In the conference room at Boeing Field, King County officials have set up two screens so the public can watch deportation flights. One screen provides a wide-angle view of the runway. The other is zoomed in. Shakuma instructs several volunteers from the Jewish Coalition for Immigrant Justice Northwest how to count the people getting on and off the plane.
If we can get it broken down into male and female, that's better.
They will share the information with the University of Washington Center for Human Rights. The center's 2019 report said nearly 35,000 immigrants had been deported from Boeing Field over 8 years. The report led to the temporary ban on deportation flights from here.
A stairway, and they'll move that up to the plane.
Shakuma tells the volunteers what they'll see once the plane comes in.
So the vested people in yellow, I think, are all the guards that come off of the plane. And the people in black are all the ICE from Northwest Detention Center. And they also usually bring in two SDPs.
On another morning, Wendy Pantoja is in Tacoma at 6 a.m., walking along the train tracks that run in front of the ICE detention center. She's a divorced mom originally from Mexico. She's at the detention center as a member of the activist group La Resistencia. She's trying to get a head count on her end of detainees boarding the bus bound for Boeing Field.
Entonces, lo que hacemos a veces es que cuando sabemos que sale un autobús, vamos con pancartas. Para decirles, no, it's not.
They hold signs and cheer, she says, to give a little bit of emotional support to the detainees.
O sea, al menos es una especie de apoyo emocional, pero es que sí es importante. Porque, pues, están tristes, separados de sus familias.
She says it's important because they are separated from their families. Sometimes Pantoja misses them because the bus has left early to go to the Yakima airport instead. That's 150 miles from the detention center. Back at Boeing Field, after hours of waiting, the volunteers finally see the ICE flight land. They're close enough to smell the engine's fumes.
Oh, there it is.
They'll estimate how many are being deported by counting the white plastic bags of belongings placed on the tarmac.
I don't think they give more than one bag per person.
The detainees who will be walking up to the plane are in shackles, with their hands tied and connected to a chain around their waist.
They can't use the railing. Can't swing their arms.
Shakuma knows the detainees can't hold on to the railing as they get on the plane. They start counting.
One, two.
Watching this scene, Jewish Coalition member Ruth Egger is reminded of her family's own history.
I can't help but think about the Holocaust.
Putting them
on the bus.
Right, people, right.
The train.
The trains.
They count more than 30 people getting on the deportation flight, bound first for Phoenix. Dina Burstein, one of the other volunteers, wonders where the detainees will go next.
We don't know what they're going back to. We could be sending them to a terrible existence.
The few immigrants who got off the plane will be taken to the ICE detention center in Tacoma. There, they'll wait for their immigration case to be resolved or be deported. Liliana Fowler, KNKX News.
Liliana Fowler covers social justice for KNKX. Email her at lfowler@knkx.org.
It's been a stressful week in the state capitol. Today is policy cutoff when many bills die in committee. There are a lot of ways that lawmakers deal with the stress. Playing basketball was a popular one in Olympia before the pandemic. KNKX reporter Scott Greenstone has more on the return of legislative hoops.
So this week is a more stressful week than most, right, because of the policy cutoff, for sure.
Dave Mastin started Legislative Hoops around a decade ago. He's a former Republican legislator and now chief lobbyist for the Association of Washington Business, and he still comes.
It's just a good opportunity for folks to blow off steam.
This Thursday night is one of the best attended yet at this community college gym in Olympia. Lawmakers, staffers, there's a Capitol security guard tonight.
Our highlight was probably when the governor came and played with us. Many years ago, he came and played, and the boy can shoot.
The pandemic in the last couple of years have brought with them a lot of infighting. So it's good to have a chance to sweat it out on the same team.
It's nonpartisan. We don't talk about bills.
I haven't seen it yet, but you know what? If an extra elbow goes out, you never know what's going on behind the scenes.
That's Julio Cortez, Democrat and freshman House member from Everett. There's a lot of freshman faces in the gym.
Everybody's in good spirits here. I think everybody appreciates having this outlet, you know? Yeah. Especially on weeks like this week.
Most of these legislators got their priority bills out of committee in time for cutoff. Cortez just got across a bill providing services for homeless and runaway youth. But in the March madness ahead, they'll have to get their top proposals through plenty of other hoops, rules and fiscal committees, the House and Senate floors. Scott Greenstone, KNKX News.
Last spring, state lawmakers set aside $70 million of revenue from Washington's Climate Commitment Act to conserve mature forests. But that's only enough for about 2,000 acres statewide. KNKX reporter Bellamy Palethorpe tagged along as community activists in Snohomish County cataloged a parcel that they want to save near Sultan.
Nearly 1,000 acres that contain 100-year-old trees on state lands in Snohomish County will likely be logged in the next 2 years.
Okay, this is a little easier than we've had it, but still bushwhacking.
Getting into the harvest unit called Ridge Ender involves climbing over logs, beating back branches, and testing your balance at every step.
I know exactly what you're stepping on.
But Kate Lunsford from the League of Women Voters is on a mission to help document big trees. Lunsford says this week they're calling on the Snohomish County Council to help prevent the logging of this unit and three others.
Immediately, right away, because time is very short to nominate them for the Natural Climate Solutions funding that is available this year.
On this trip, they find a hemlock that's the biggest one they've ever seen here and probably at least 150 years old. They add it to their list of legacy trees in this claim that predate the invention of the modern chainsaw. Bellamy Palethorpe, KNKX News.
It's 4:32. I'm Emil Moffitt with KNKX News. Good afternoon. A nonprofit plans to pilot the first guaranteed income program in the country for indigenous communities. The Stranger reports Hummingbird Indigenous Family Services will give up to 150 indigenous families monthly payments of $1,250. The program will start at pregnancy and continue until a child's third birthday. A recent report from the State Department of Health shows American Indian and Alaska Natives have a higher maternal mortality ratio than other ethnic groups. Ukrainians who fled the ongoing war in Eastern Europe gathered at a Tacoma church last week. They told state and local leaders about how they're faring since moving to Washington State. KNKX reporter Liliana Fowler was there.
One after another, Ukrainians stepped up to a microphone and, with the help of a translator, expressed gratitude.
The American community accepted us very welcome.
But many also spoke of struggling to pay rent or even find housing. Others noted that they had had good jobs back home but couldn't use their degrees here. Oleg Pinda of the Ukrainian Community Center of Washington says he's heard lots of similar stories, including from a commercial pilot.
He got a school here. His degree is actually from here. But he is not able to find a job because actually his pilot license being printed in Ukraine.
State lawmakers in attendance say they hope the listening session is the first step in advocating for more state aid and supporting more local help to get refugees to work. Liliana Fowler, KNKX News.
Well, it's that time of year when the weather is changing. People are posting photos of pumpkin spice lattes on social media and of spiders invading their homes.
And this guy came out of nowhere. Hello, dude. And I'm going to kill him.
That's the voice of KNKX reporter Freddy Monades, who recently caught a large spider in his home. The News Tribune reports spider activity is more prevalent during August and September in western Washington. Common spiders seen during this period include giant house spiders and cross-orb weaver spiders. Rob Crawford, curator of arachnids at the University of Washington, tells the newspaper, it's not actually spider season. Rather, giant house spiders seem more active as males become mature and are looking for a female to mate with. The season of spider love typically lasts until September.
Classical music, it's not usually associated with Latinos. The Seattle nonprofit Orchestra Northwest, made up of both the Ballard Civic Orchestra and the World Youth Orchestra, is changing that. KNKX reporter Liliana Fowler brings us the story about the Mexican female conductor leading the organization.
Hello, my name is Paula Madrigal. I am a cellist and a conductor.
One, two, one, two, three.
I meet up with Madrigal at a community center in Seattle's Ballard neighborhood. The room is filled with musicians of all ages, high school students, retired folks. Some are Latino, others aren't. Rose Gear is one of the students in the Ballard Civic Orchestra.
And I feel like more so than any other conductor I've worked with, she gets you to feel the music, which is really, really, really fun.
I know, buena de Viva Mexico. Viva Mexico!
Madrigal is walking her students through their upcoming performance at Town Hall, commemorating El Grito. El Grito refers to El Grito de Dolores, where a Mexican priest in 1810 inspired an uprising against the Spaniards after centuries of colonial rule. Mexicans today shout Viva Mexico as a way to remember that war of independence. Madrigal met some of the musicians in the orchestra through the nonprofit Casa Latina, where she offers free instrument classes to underserved kids. Others in the orchestra are professional musicians.
Algunos son nuestros alumnos, otros son músicos profesionales que se unen para apoyar a los más jóvenes.
The magic behind the orchestra, Madrigal says, is the sense of community it builds.
Pero esa es la magia de la orquesta, de que esa es la manera de hacer comunidad.
Madrigal is from Guadalajara. She always liked to sing and play music, but she never imagined she would do it professionally.
Yo empecé con la música porque me gustaba. Pues me gustaba cantar, me gustaba tocar. Tenía una vida como músico profesional, nunca fue parte de mis planes.
One of her inspirations was Alondra de la Parra, a world-renowned conductor who once served as the artistic director of Jalisco Philharmonic Orchestra in Guadalajara. She spoke for a documentary posted to YouTube.
I remember when I was 13, 14, that I already wanted to be a conductor, that I thought, how am I going to be a conductor if I don't look anything like the conductors? The conductors are supposed to be German and very old and with white hair. And I'm Mexican.
Madrigal says Alondra de la Parra has received plenty of pushback for her role, but likely opened doors for other women.
Aunque ella recibió mucho rechazo por medio mundo, eso facilitó un poco las cosas en México y en Guadalajara, que se abrían un poco las puertas más hacia las mujeres.
Y ahora vamos a presentar a Paula Madrigal, quien es la directora de la Ballard Civic Orchestra. Let's introduce Paula Madrigal, conductor of the Ballard Civic Orchestra.
The orchestra Madrigal conducts reached a milestone recently with the El Grito performance. Hundreds of people packed into the auditorium. Madrigal says seeing so many brown people in the crowd filled her with joy.
Y más de que vi tantas caras conocidas y tantas caras morenas, eso me impactó muchísimo y me dio muchísimo gusto.
Among Madrigal's favorite songs at the performance is El Feo, about a man who says he's ugly but knows how to love. Madrigal invited Oaxacan performer Maria Reina to sing it at Town Hall. She sang parts of the song in the indigenous languages of Zapoteco and Mije. But Madrigal says no matter the language, live music is universal because it enlivens all the senses.
Muy impresionante, ¿no? Porque te entra por todos los sentidos. Ves a los músicos tocar, escuchas. Es una experiencia.
Madrigal's next performance at Town Hall with the Ballard Civic Orchestra will be a celebration of Las Posadas, or the Christmas story, in December. Liliana Fowler, KNKX News.
Liliana Fowler covers social justice, focusing on immigration and labor. You can email her at lfowler@knkx.org.